Good morning, everybody. Good morning. I'm incredibly happy to be welcoming you this morning and to be welcoming the guests that have agreed to join me on this panel this morning, which is Matthias Poletner, Silke Otto Knapp, and Paulina Orlowska. Allow me to say a few words to introduce this panel's topic, which is about the pitfalls of referentiality and how to avoid them. So I realized in the last years that one thing that has consistently upset me somehow is a particular attitude that I find very prominent in the way how art that deals with history is being discussed, and I would also argue in the way how a lot of artists who try to feed this discussion deal with their work, which is to deal with history as if it was some kind of dart game where you intentionally aim at a particular field on the dartboard and you try to get the score right, and then the critic is supposed to kind of count the score and decide who won the dart game, whether it was one party or the other. And of course, you can play these games with historicity, that you intentionally, strategically invoke certain artists, certain events in the past to communicate or to take a particular ideological position. But I find the debates that kind of approach to history produces particularly depressing. These debates can be amiable. It can be, I don't know, the Vancouver's Boys Club playing the dart game of historic referentiality, or you can have the more Germanic version of it, then it's kind of two teams against each other, the institutional critics against the new romantics, or it can be the Kippenberger version where it's Kippenberger against everyone in the pub. But my intuition is that maybe we're not getting very far if we treat art that deals with historicity only on that strategical level. And one reason why I've continuously enjoyed the work of the artists that have joined me today on the panel is because I have a feeling that they all open up a much wider horizon in the manner how they invoke historicity or engage with historicity continuously over time, taking a very close look at the medium in which they bring those ghosts back, be that film and photography in Matthias' case, painting in Silke's case, and painting and installation art at large in Paulina's case. And I find the conditions in the work for a debate that could be potentially much wider than just a debate about identifying who threw the dart first. And this morning I would like to engage in a conversation about what kind of concepts we could use or invoke to really develop a much wider sense of what it means to engage with particular events, styles, approaches from history, but also from a wider cultural field. So I would want to start by introducing the work of my guests, by asking each of them a number of questions, and then we will start to discuss things a bit more widely, and then I will open it up to you, the audience, to ask questions. So we would want to start with one piece by Matthias, which has to do with a very particular space that you based a film on, which is a greenhouse, right?
It's an actual... Well, what I would like to do is I would like to show three different examples of how maybe reference is not the perfect word for it, but in how sort of cultural artifacts factor into my work or are being play a role in my work. And the first example is a film that I did a few years ago. It's a film of essentially that I shot in Papua New Guinea in the rainforest. And what I would like to present is a short sequence of the soundtrack of that piece. So shall we?
Yeah, could we play the first sound file, please?
Thank you. So this was the film of which this forms the soundtrack in some way is a piece that is close to 30 minutes long, and it consists of three static takes of three scenes that were shot within the rainforest. Each scene has sort of a little bit of a different characteristic, but what unites all scenes is that they are static shots that are very tightly framed and sort of establish an overall pattern that is close to something that's almost abstract. And why I would describe this piece and the soundtrack as a cultural artifact is that the soundtrack is sort of highly constructed in the sense that it consists of recordings that were made on site as well as archival field recordings that were put together as a collage or as an assemblage or as a composition in some way. And each of these three scenes have sort of a distinct variation on this theme of the soundtrack. And also in the sense that even though there's a paradox in the understanding, if we talk about something as that in effect constitutes what we think of as nature, and I speak of it as a cultural artifact, it is a cultural artifact by virtue of the fact that it is being filmed, by virtue of the fact that the soundtrack is being recorded, all of which is certainly not natural, but sort of brings in certain a certain cultural understanding as well as a certain cultural apparatus for these recordings. And let's maybe go to the second sort of cultural artifact that I would like to show.
We have the images, please.
So this is a this in some way is a little bit it's kind of a little bit of a ping pong match that I've been playing with my colleagues and fellow artists, Christopher Williams and Willem de Roy, which they also talk about in the current issue of Frieze magazine. And this is sort of the backside of a wall that's being presented in the magazine. And this is from an exhibition that I did in collaboration with Christopher Williams at the Bonner Kunstverein. And we were invited to collaborate on an exhibition. And maybe to some degree we took this interest in collaboration or desire for us to collaborate maybe more extreme, to a more extreme than it was really desired by the institution. Because obviously on some level, both Christopher and myself are being considered producers of images. And even though the framing of these images and the architecture and the way these images are presented, I think in both of our works play a very crucial role, and we put quite a bit of effort into how these images can actually be seen in an art context. Usually the primary production is the production of images, and in my case, moving images. And in this case, that relationship was sort of turned around, and we sort of established sort of a very limited parameter for this exhibition in that we said this exhibition is not going to include any image whatsoever. And so this was a show, kind of an almost scientific or anthropological study of wall systems, but sort of from a perversely narrow angle, in that we said we are showing a survey of wall systems from the Rhineland. And so the exhibition consisted of walls that are coming from different institutions in the Rhineland, from the Bonner Kunstverein, from Düsseldorf, from the Kunstmuseum, as well as from the Bonner Kunstverein itself. And this is actually the wall that the Bonner Kunstverein uses as a mobile wall system. It can be sort of moved around and rebuilt again. And what we did is this particular wall, and why I'm showing the backside of this wall here is, and in the magazine you can see the front. Well, maybe actually we can show the front here too. So the front was used as a some sort of display system, and we used all these walls in a way that were entirely untouched. It was just sort of put together, but they were not cleaned up in any way, with the exception of this wall, where the front side is sort of like perfectly cleaned up and patched and polished and painted in order to provide sort of this introductory panel, and then the back side sort of shows how the wall is just sort of when you put it together. Obviously all these walls in that show could be described as cultural artifacts, and there's a certain functionality in showing these works, even though it's very unclear for whom this function actually serves any purpose. And then let's maybe go to the next, to the third. This is another image of another wall system. I think this in particular is from the Kunstmuseum Bonn. So they all have These are all modular systems that can be employed in various ways. And then this is an image from a fairly recent film that I produced. And what you see here is one example of a group of glass pieces. The whole group could be called a bar set. And it was produced by, designed by the Austrian architect Adolf Loos in the late 1920s, and produced by an Austrian company called Lobmeier. And it's obviously Loos is known for sort of a highly moralistic stance with regard to decoration and ornamentation. It's sort of like an important sort of modernist figure in that sense, but at the same time, there's sort of a lot of ambiguity and ambivalence in his creations, and this would be an example on some level, in the sense that the reduction of the form to this sort of simple cylinder type shape. All the elements of the bar set it's I think the total group consists of 13 elements. So there's a sherry glass, there's a wine glass, there's a white wine glass, there's a beer glass, there's a whiskey glass, double old fashioned, there's a water pitcher, there are sort of all these elements. But for the most part, they're sort of like sort of declinate almost language-like, declinate the same form, just in different sizes. So in that sense, it's sort of a very modernist project. At the same time, with Loos, there's sort of a perverse fetishism of materials, which is quite unlike to many other modernist projects of that period, in the sense that the bottom of the glasses, it's a little bit hard to see here, but the bottom of the glasses have a diamond cut pattern that is sort of like hand cut into it, and that sort of creates sort of a very delicate and sophisticated light effect. And it's also quite historicist in the sense that this type of pattern actually comes from a sort of traditional 19th century Biedermeier, sort of Viennese Biedermeier treatment of objects. So there's a lot of ambiguity in these things. But I should also point out that in the film itself, you see sort of a selection of these different types that follow one after another, or sort of that sort of declinate these different elements. But there's sort of a kind of a contradictory separation between the information that maybe I have just given you, in that I talk about the history of these objects, and then what the film actually represents, because the film is sort of like almost abstract and does not provide any of this information. So one could view the film without any of the knowledge of what this is or where it is coming from, and it would sort of present some more of a type of alienated form, if you will, that's maybe sort of a little bit more bizarre, but in some ways it's almost reminiscent of sort of the old soluid project of the incomplete open cubes, where sort of like one form is being declinated in different types. Yeah, so maybe we can just take it from here now.
Exactly. I mean, as a critic, one sometimes has the stupid tendency to destroy jokes by explaining them, and I want to try to restrain myself. But what I appreciate about your work is that there is a particular sense of irony involved that you've started gesturing towards in the end now. Because it seems on the one hand, you push a certain approach to cultural history at large to extremes by really appropriating what you call cultural artifacts. So it's not just references, you're not just alluding to something, but you're getting the actual thing. And what counts as an artifact here is glass, glasses, mm-hmm. design objects, a whole natural environment, a jungle, mm-hmm. And display technologies.
Yeah.
So there is already something like an inherent humor to kind of treating a jungle in the same way as you would treat the technical facilities of a white cube gallery and the historical design objects.
Yeah, and I think there's also some maybe sort of some a perverse logic at play somehow in sort of like the setup, the construction, on the rules. In some way, all these pieces involve a certain type of rules, a certain given set of rules that is sort of that are followed to the teeth, even though maybe they are set quite arbitrarily. But for example, in the rainforest piece, which is called the Crystal Palace, I really set out to create an image or create a group of images that is very close to sort of our collective memory of or our collective idea of how a rainforest would look like. So I really sort of set out to create an image that is not very different of sort of our generic idea of what the rainforest would look like. But nevertheless, I did in fact travel to Papua New Guinea and created that image or found that image. But it was sort of an image that I had in my mind already and that I made sort of the reality conform with that image on some level.
So on the level of the image and the presentation, we do get a tension between something being entirely generic, a glass, a wall, a forest, and at the same time being absolutely specific, because it's that particular glass with that particular cut, those particular leaves, those particular sounds that we've heard,
yeah.
And the walls with all their traces of use.
Yeah.
And I guess another tension that is somehow inherent to these works is that they play with what you would have described as the cultural artifact that we always already seem to know and that we can actually seize and appropriate. Well, you can get those glasses. But at the same time, I think they also gesture towards something that is there as an experience, but which is not exactly identical with the artifact. No, there is something beautiful about hearing those forest noises.
Yeah.
And you spoke about the difference between nature and the cultural artifact in the beginning. Could you maybe say a few
words? Yeah, and then I think there's also a very sort of harsh or sort of drastic separation of sort of the history or the cultural context of where these materials come from, and then the presentation itself, and of sort of like over the last couple of years, sort of I've moved maybe even to a more extreme separation of sort of the text and the image somehow, and I'm quite interested in the notion of encountering these images. Or sort of at least creating the possibility for encountering these images without any information whatsoever and sort of function as pieces that are produced in a certain way and that have a certain logic that unfolds within the piece in terms of the timing, in terms of sort of what they, in terms of the narrative or non-narrative or the absence of narrative or sort of what is missing there at the same time, too.
Because it seems when we compare your strategy of working with that of mainstream cinema, it seems like mainstream cinema, whenever it approaches a particular cultural space or a particular historical space, cinema tries to complete the mise-en-scene that you get, I don't know, London 1820, and cinema tries to produce a total vision of that environment where nothing is ever missing or lacking. And it seems with your strategy, on the one hand, you make things very specific, you seize the object, but at the same time, there is a sense of somehow the thing not being present in its representation. There is the jungle, yes, we see it, but the noises also seem to come from elsewhere.
Yeah. Well, I've always been interested in as much as I'm interested in sort of the actual presentation of an image, I've been interested in what is lacking or what is not there, and what sort of the presence of the image suggests as what is missing at the same time.
Which you could understand as a critical approach, you know, trying to dismantle the powerful illusion of cinema that you could actually seize each and every object and drag it into the frame of representation and make it complete. That with you, you on the one hand, you seize it as a material object, but there is this kind of emptiness that allows the thought that something is missing to actually resonate in the image.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been intrigued by what Lévi-Strauss said in his book The Way of the Masks, in which he talks about these masks from Canada, and he talks about how they are constructed, but sort of that all the elements of the mask point to the absence. So what they produce, it's not just important what they produce, but also what they negate and what is not in what elements are not in the mask.
Mm-hmm. Maybe just one last question, and then we proceed to the next presentation. There's one film that we have chosen not to include an image of, but which I've always found very fascinating. It's a piece called Actualité, where you show a kind of a post-punk band in the process of rehearsing, and it's unclear in the film which temporal moment they actually inhabit, if they're restaging that moment of 1978 or something, or whether it's actually a retro band. And that kind of ambivalence is mirrored by their way of approaching their music. So you never know whether they're actually starting or stopping, whether things are coming together or falling apart. And what I like about that work is that it doesn't only play with what we've just described. So the question, is that a real band or is the real thing still absent? But it also treats a moment in pop history as this kind of strange potential of which we are not entirely sure whether it has ever happened or not, so that we're not just dealing with spaces and images as artifacts, but also with events in history.
I think that's very true. And another interesting aspect to me to this work is because it's sort of it has sort of like certain very specific historical signifiers, even though it's really unclear what they all together represent, but they certainly allude to a very specific moment or sort of a moment that can really be sort of boiled down almost to a year or to something very narrow. But what's interesting to me is also that the reception of the piece or how you would look at the piece is sort of highly contingent upon which historical moment we are in ourselves. When I was creating that piece, for example, this particular sort of pop culture moment, if you will, was sort of not really very present. And when I was looking, and actually also not, especially not present as sort of an audiovisual production, because this period was sort of just before the emergence of MTV, so that means it was not really, there was not a really a lot of audiovisual representation. There was a lot of representation in terms of album covers and in terms of graphics, etc. So I was interested in sort of creating that. But what's interesting is that maybe only one or two years later, this moment has become so popular that even though at the time I was producing this, sort of the look and the appearance of the people in that piece seemed kind of silly or absurd almost, 2 years later every indie band started to look like that, and it has sort of become the generic look. And now of course we're sort of at a different moment already where this look is already sort of totally out fashioned again. And so it's interesting to me, sort of, you know, sort of what our current position sort of brings into the reception of the piece as well.
And I guess it's also a question of a lingering potential that resides in certain events, where it's entirely up to the next generation to decide how to inhabit it. And
yeah.
I don't know if that's a good way to lead over to Silke's work, because it seems that the question of a historical potential and how to actualize it and relate to it is a question that also appears in your work, as in your painting you have been relating to particular events, among others, in the history of ballet. But what complicates your way of relating to them is that you not only relate to the spirit and impact of certain events, but you do so in a medium which is not the same medium that you're relating to. So you're relating through dance in the medium of painting. And this is an image from a show in Oslo.
Yeah, where exactly. I think it's... does that work? I think I have a probably much more messy relationship to using existing cultural reference and existing cultural artifacts or historical moments than Matthias has, and I'm using a lot of different images, moments in time, coming from different kinds of contexts. And I think but I think there is a shared interest maybe in the fact that I'm already starting with looking at images that are complete in a way that are already that are representing a particular moment in time or a particular, you know, artwork or place or history. But at the same time, I think in the way I take that as a starting point for a painting process, I guess. And my approach to how to work with these references is really very much determined by the process of what happens in the painting, and where I don't quite know where I'm going with that and what the outcome of it might be. And I think this exhibition just opened last month, and I thought it would be interesting to look at these very new paintings because the exhibition invited five people to each select a piece of work that they would like to make work in, you know, referring to, and that could be very literal or very open. There was no other brief, really. So I selected this. What you see here is the film of Yvonne Reynaud's Trio A from 1974 or something like this. And we didn't just show the film. We also invited a dancer who's trained and authorized to perform it, to come from New York to actually do a live performance of it. And I had never, for instance, seen this before. So I think that's quite... I know the film very well, and I've seen aspects, you know, parts of it appeared in performances and things like this, but I've never seen the whole dance performed, even though I've referred to it in paintings many times. And I think I might have arrived at these... at this particular dance through finding one image and then investigating more what is, you know, what that moment in time was. It's really not a research project that happens before I make the paintings. And that's why I think here the painting on the left, I think there is like an actual picture of it.
Yeah.
Refers to it very directly. That's actually... refers to a couple of performances of it that did happen, or existing images of it. But I sort of combined different sources, and somehow in the process of working on these paintings, I've also always, I guess it's constructed spaces and scenarios that I'm interested in, and a particular kind of and what marks them out. And so I think I'd been working with a lot of interiors that are very defined by color. So I was thinking about this idea of a very soft moonlight that I guess it relates to, you know, my interest in silver surfaces and their reflective quality that's been something that's been important to, you know, the way I translate images that I find into paintings, and like Matthias said, I guess for me it's very, it's also a lot to do with what to reveal and what not to reveal, and the painting not being, it's not being very clear how it is actually, how it is, it doesn't necessarily, it doesn't reveal very clearly how it is made. Maybe that's what I'm trying to say. You know, it's like...
Can I ask a question?
Mm.
Does it make a difference whether the sort of historical moment you pick up is sort of more recent or from the 60s or something even more historical from the beginning of the last century in the way you treat it? Or are you primarily concerned with the configuration of figures in space?
I think it's quite a... I think it's really quite a... I think that there is a... I don't have a plan as to how I'm going to treat it necessarily, mm-hmm. I think. But where I might reach, I've made paintings referring to Trio A over the years mm-hmm. quite a few times. And then so it might appear again in a different constellation later on. And mm-hmm. in between there might have been, landscapes or, stage sets, different kinds of scenarios that might refer to something. I think there is a connection between the references that I'm interested in. They're not random at all, and they're always there. They're particular moments in time and maybe in the history of dance or in the history of stage design that I might be interested in. And mm-hmm. I think, like you, it's usually the ones. I'm not looking for particularly obscure references or anything like that. I think it's often the moments where something quite quite important might have happened, and quite mm-hmm. so. And, mm-hmm. and so I don't necessarily think I decide to treat it in a particular way, but I think I arrive at a particular image at a particular time, determined through what's been happening before mm-hmm. in the process of, in what I've been working on. Yeah. So it's really not,
but,
it's a process
but
driven.
But the sort of the primary driving force in your interest, is it the cultural moment or sort of the potential that you see for your work on a sort of the compositional
the potential I see for my work, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like
obviously it cannot be fully separated,
maybe we should add as an information that the exhibition in Norway was extraordinary in the sense that you would normally never present the source of the images parallel to the work, but is a new...
Maybe we can go back to
the new situation.
Because, for instance, there is that... That's why I'm talking about this very kind of... I think what I was trying to get at, that it's really... I started out trying to somehow keep in mind that I was... That I had picked the Trio A as my work to display, and then I actually arrived at wanting to paint, stage sets or landscapes that were moonlit, and so right next to the Trio A is actually a painting of a landscape that could be a backdrop, or it could be an actual landscape that's moonlit, and then that then led to the stage, the interior of the stage, carrying that through it, that same kind of formal interest at that particular moment, and so that what made it possible for me to display. I would never usually. I obviously show the source next to it, but I think it makes it quite—it's quite interesting to see how different it actually is. The film, or seeing the dancer actually moving in space to what happens in my painting project, which is really maybe we can go to the next one.
Yeah. I mean, what I also find exciting about this is, in my perception, your way in a way of inhabiting that. Cultural moment that Yvonne Rainer produced in the 60s, that speaking about the potential of it, why should we just be forced to articulate the potential of an event that is dance within that medium of dance, when there can be a way of inquiring into the potential of that event through painting, through the particular logic and humor of painting, of thinking about bodies and space, how to open up space, how to dissimulate space, how to put a figure on a stage, all of which are considerations that would motivate a dancer. Mm. But I think you meditate on similar questions in the way how you build your
paintings. Yeah, but I'm not trying to somehow reproduce the experience of seeing a dance performance or something like that. You know, it's really, really quite different. Already taking the still image as a starting point is quite a different place to move from. And then I think it's really it really is determined by considerations within the formal considerations that I might be. That I might be interested in or invested in, that might have been articulated very differently in other paintings, you know, in the way that a space is created, in the way that the figure relates to the background, what's in the foreground, what's in the background, and how do these things interrelate? And so it's, I think that's always the determining factor leading me to be interested in an image to use as a starting point. But then that's, of course, not random, but there is a sort of layering of particular moments in history and interests that feed into that. And maybe that we can go to the Stadtheimer one. Yeah, that's an installation shot from the from an exhibition in the Kunstverein in Munich. And the I think it's also important As the sources can be quite varying. I think it's I really think of exhibitions as maybe temporary scenarios where I can relate those different on the level of the image that I'm referring to, but also on the level of how they're developed as a painting can create relationships between things. And so the paintings on the left and the right are both referring to this artist that has featured quite strongly in a recent body of work, Florine Stadtheimer. Sure. Yeah, that's a detail of the painting. That's actually a portrait of her. But again, I would say it's not so much. I mean, that's that in an interest in sort of like female artists or performers' biographies is something that always has accompanied me in a way, and occasionally there will be an image that I think could would relate to. Maybe landscape paintings that I have made in the past, or I'm not here in this particular case. I was interested in the way that she is positioned in space, and so it's not just a portrait of Florine Stadtheimer. That's just one level of entry point in a way. Mm-hmm. But it really how the painting is constructed and how the figure emerges from the background and how she is positioned within that space. That's an actual painting by her, and I think I'm always struggling with introducing color to my paintings. So I've been looking at her work a lot in terms of how she's doing that, and also she always has this perspective of a proscenium stage, looking at the scene from above. And she hosted a salon in New York in the 20s, 30s, that together with her sisters, that a lot of artists, writers, and intellectuals participated in. She was good friends with Duchamp, for instance. And so she's kind of an interesting figure, both in terms of her life and biography and in the way she addresses that in her work. She never really showed her work during her lifetime, but she's certainly not a secret. I mean, people, her paintings are in museums, and she's been picked up by 80s, maybe feminist criticism, again, and sort of people know about her. But I think I'm actually very interested in her as a figure, but really in her paintings, and so made some paintings of her live and workspace. So she hosted the salon, and her studio was in the room next door, and she actually used cellophane curtains to separate her studio from her living room, because that was like the sort of modern material at the time, the fashionable material. And so I made two paintings. Maybe you can show the other one, where you can see from one side of the, looking into the studio from the living room, and then the other side, looking back into the living room. this one was supposed to be in color as well, but somehow that didn't that didn't work out in the process. But when the other one, I sort of managed to keep it with maybe her use of color in mind. But just looking back at the, you know, at the Oslo exhibition and the paintings, you know, of like a completely different kind of construction of a dance space, I think I look at these interior paintings very much as stage constructions as well, and also the garden that the, you know, that the, a single figure would have been placed in. So I think it's really not random, disjointed references that are sort of vaguely connected by particular by, you know, biographies or women art, but that it's, I think that's what I've been trying to stress, that it's really, you know, it's driven by what happens in each painting, where that might lead me next, and how I'm going to articulate that problem the next time, you know.
But it's interesting when it comes to someone like Stettheimer, that a lot of your concerns are actually also mirrored maybe in her work. The way how in her paintings, as you were saying, she treats space like a stage, and mm-hmm. and situates figures in the painting as if they were dancers, but they are social performers. So that social performers and dancers are almost like they play a similar role, and not just in the way how the painting represents a social scene, but also very much how the painting enacts it, you know, by putting those people on stage literally in the way how it's painted, so that the logic of the painting, of dealing with the stage backdrop or with the way how a painting opens up space as a stage or closes it again, is very much in tune with the way how I think we also perceive a social scenario, no? Like where a room might be a stage that closes or opens.
Mm-hmm.
But another thing that you mentioned was that with Stettheimer, the interest is as much in her work as in her biography. And there is something I find fascinating about these spaces where that seems to be precisely the motif that you're reflecting there. How That's the life of a painter... Where the kind of biography and the work somehow strangely interlaces.
But at the same time, I think in the same way that, you know, Matthias was saying, I think it's not necessary to know any of these things that I'm now explaining, who she was, what she was doing, where she was positioned, or anything like that. You don't have to know that this is Florine Stettheimer's studio in order to look at the painting or understand the concerns that are in the painting in a way. That's one level of entry. But it's not, you know, but it's again, it's also what's represented and what's, you know, and what's missing, how much is revealed and how much is not depicted. And it's, here, for instance, it was kind of a interesting decision in terms of, you know, the paintings. Was I going to copy the paintings into my painting, or how was I going to leave blank spaces on the canvases? And so the solution somehow revealed itself through the process by sort of trial and error, putting it on and then taking it away and articulating it a bit more in the paravent, in the background, you know. But it's so I think that's you know, I think with Stettheimer herself, her biography and her paintings are completely inseparable and interlinked, and that's what would have led me to be interested in her and refer to her in this.
For me, it also feels like a very strong statement to not just refer to the work, but also to the way how it is situated in that kind of strange, ambiguous space, which is a space where you live and work, as a strong statement in favor of looking at art in a particular way, not at just these monological manifestations, but as something that very much has to do with the creation of a social space where her salon and her work were deeply connected.
I think that's true. That's definitely in there. But at the same time, it's again, I look at it as a staged scenario with, you know, where particular elements come together the same way that I would have, that for me that connects to the garden that she's standing in the portrait, and the way that space is constructed, and the 308 Judson Church context that the first black and white painting was in, you know, and
But speaking about these cultural spaces, that might be a way to lead over to a very particular cultural space that you have been engaging with in a very recent project, which is the cultural space of the
puppet theater. So, recently I had discovered that time and images move differently in different spaces. And what I mean is maybe a comparison of a cosmopolitan city to a faraway city, for example, in, I would say, still Eastern Europe, to a village or to a small town. And this is a wall painting in a small town called Rabka in Poland. And it's a theater that, well, Rabka, maybe for a little bit cultural references, Rabka is a sanatorium town, a spa for children, which was one of the kind of miracles of socialism, that we produced spas or towns that children, for example, with long diseases could go for the summer. And this town doesn't have much to offer to the children besides mountains, fresh air. So in 1950s, they established a little puppet theater that through the years they had many fantastic plays, and it stood as this kind of haunting little building. You could go to slide number two, next to a church, so it's right in the center of the town. And this summer, together with students and high school kids, we decided to make a proposal to make a wall painting, to make it kind of as an on a monumental monument of time. And I went through a beautiful research of puppets and old posters, and together with the group, we had decided that the most kind of visually striking posters were from 1960s. And based on the design, we had made this three wall painting. We can move to the.
But it's something. The motifs were from books that you found in the archive of the theater, or were the books around?
They were actually posters that were for particular plays that were made by Linacott. So, so I was, of course, interested in this kind of minor but beautiful art scene being completely undiscovered, unknown, and very local. And by also, I guess, this applied fantastic, which I would call further. So in case of lack of means and needs, how do you make posters? And these posters are from 60s and 70s, and how they did it is that they had their local press, and just by simple etching, each poster was handmade and posted around, so maybe 50 of them existed. So it's from a particular place. I don't know the translation of them very well in English, but this is Tom. It's not the peeping Tom, but it's Tom on a little boat, and then the... Yeah, there are just specific, very specific kind of fairy tales that existed. The puppets, I mean, it was a devastating, everything is more, in more or less devastating stage. It's kind of like Mike Kelly said, inside as well. So it's a little bit of a contrast of the inside and the outside. It's it has this specific kind of smell and I guess it's like a time machine, that it's not much changed there from this 1960s.
I think what's beautiful about the motifs is that on the one hand they are so very particular and specific, and the technique in which they were produced, but when you look at them now, there's also something quite universal about them. That they speak about that particular history, but at the same time they do so in a way that is so open that you can instantly, well, I could like Tom. I can easily see.
Well, I was a little bit referring with the choice of images also to Polish and Eastern European techniques of 60s wall painting and wall advertising. So all of them were quite simplified, and I'm a little bit amazed that kind of simplification of images nowadays in advertising is done. There's 3D everywhere, it's kind of 3D. So I wanted to refer to this kind of technique of flatness and creating kind of very, very modest op art illusionism, and also a technique which is called sgraffito, which is a brilliant technique, which is that you put paint under the cement and then you dig in that cement. Mm-hmm. This wasn't done with this technique because it was not affordable time-wise, but it has this kind of very particular look of sgraffito.
And speaking about very particular techniques...
This is a project that I'm working on, a painting project, which I called Applied Fantastic. And let me tell you a little bit about the reference, because this is a very specific reference. And I guess my way of dealing with references is either digging something really specific that you find on the end of the bin and thinking, this is incredible that nobody had seen it, so I would not want to share it. Or another way is a way of making something from the past really current, so making it say it's really a way that we could work on it now. So this is images from 1970s and 80s, and I have this huge fascination with fashion and fashion history, specifically Eastern European. So in the time of kind of proletariat Poland, there was no fashion doesn't exist, and in general, fashion was so-called kind of gray. Overalls and donkey jackets, that women should look like this. But fortunately, the women could rebel, and we had ladies in 60 that were called, so-called by newspapers, kittens. Yes, and kittens were those ladies that they said, we won't wear those overalls. We want to wear elegant, colorful clothes from the West. But of course, there was no way to get the clothes from the West. So the youth, men and women from 60s on, they would either dress from what was found in the cupboard of their grandparents and remake it, or from the West we would get packages from charities. And this is what was the time which is called Applied Fantastic by David Crowley. And what do I mean about Applied Fantastic is improvised necessity. And improvised necessity is how do you make something out of nothing, yes? Or how do you create an outfit that that is still kind of having the sense of longing of a vision, but has this kind of charm, I guess, also in it. So going back to the paintings. Going back to the paintings, these are made based on postcards from 70s and 80s found in a kiosk. Kiosks were little stands of newspapers, and they were called like something from nothing, or do it at home, or trendy patches. And basically it was on the back of the postcard you would have a drawing of how to make this particular jumper, because these are all actually jumpers. So it wrote, the first one, the word pszczoła means a bee outfit, yes? And then torcik is a cake. And then the other one is a chess player. So, and I... And of course, I loved also the poses of those women, this kind of strangeness in them. And their way of kind of saying, no matter what, we will survive with our fashion, and we are kind of proud of it. And of course, there was an interest of real women as well. So they're all real women. There was no sense of models at all. They were just kind of girls taken from the street, basically, in a kind of homemade studios. So it was just kind of a weird time where, as David Crowley wrote a beautiful article on it, and he would say that these deprived replicas were simply better. They could exist and be visions at the same time. So this is my interest was in this advertising without a product, because the product didn't exist, because the product was the same for over 10 years. Like, so people had to kind of deal with this lack of things. And now you can show. And this is 2010.
But it's interesting because the postcards are not actually advertising the product. They're actually giving instructions on how to do it yourself, no?
Yes, it's also a kind of, I just found it a beautiful way of sharing creativity with everyone and kind of praising this level of appliedness of art as to a higher stage. Because of course, when I was in the process of making the works, I would get stories how many women were actually making those sweaters at the same time. And I could, in my mind, I was thinking like, I would like to see a version of the sweater in 5 different cities as well. But actually didn't happen. So these are 5 sweaters followed by the instructions, handmade now.
And so basically what you're tapping into there is not just a particular artifact, but more or less an entire phenomenon of a popular form of creativity. Are they waterproof? that has its very own political implications in a sense. You brought another images from another project that equally deals with that moment of applied fantastic and this kind of strange idea of a consumer culture beyond capitalism, mm-hmm. which is relates to the history of a particular history and of Polish neon signs.
Yes, well, the story of the neon started for me in 2006 when, together with the Foundation of Gallery Foxal in Warsaw, we decided to reconstruct one of the largest, tallest neons ever made in Warsaw, which was the volleyball player. And since this moment, 2006, neons had become pop. It's an incredible kind of interest and trend for working with neons and rediscovering this amazing, fascinating way of advertising. Which also combined this applied fantastic meaning of that they were not advertising anything, because how in Monopoly you can advertise a thing. So there would be neons with signs saying, let's meet in cinema or read books, yes. And incredible kind of also sign, which were kind of modernistically geometrical as well.
You were also saying that one of the problems is obviously that since you now got the proper neon signs saying Siemens and Samsung and that these old neon signs started disappearing because no one took care of them anymore and they just started crumbling on the roofs of the building. I hope that is watertight. So that in a way you could see the disappearance of a particular idea of how the city could be and how the city could look, because these old neons were being overwritten by the new language of neons. Yeah. So
by neons, because I would say it's mostly billboards and this kind of flat pieces of plastic kind of hanging. Yeah. Yes. Well, sorry to interrupt you, but in the 60s, there was about 1,670 neons just in Warsaw, from pharmacy to Russian watches, yes? And during this process of working with neons and discovering more and more, we found an archive of, I don't know, it could be like 3,000 original drawings of the neons. And this is an example of one with a stamp. They were all handmade with instructions how to make them. And the Museum of Modern Art in Warsaw is working on archiving them because they're molded and just in terrible stage. So when invited for a public art project in Graz this summer, which I find very difficult to think of a public sculpture, what does it mean and what will it mean for the others especially, I decided to, based on the drawings that I found, to recreate three of them. So it's the cow with the blinking eye, it is going like this, and flowers and Natasha's, three kind of symbols which are very specific also to the times. Giving flowers was very common. Natasha's as a kind of celebration of the Russian babushka style, and the cow standing for the milk bar canteen. And what was important for me, it was great having them in Graz, but we had signed an agreement kind of with Graz, and I'm working on it from the side of Warsaw, that these neons should travel also back to the places which they really were meant for. Because, funny enough, the milk bar still exists as one of the only, maybe one or two places like this in Warsaw, and the flower shop still exists. There's not just anymore a folk gift shop with Hungarian and Russian souvenirs, but maybe we'll make one in the future.
But I remember two terms that you kept using in relation to these projects were appreciation, and then you do have a very articulate sense of what nostalgia could mean today. You know, going back to something in an appreciative manner.
Yeah.
Could you maybe say a few words on your notion of nostalgia?
Well, The thing is that it's kind of a necessity that I think I was always talking about, that I just kind of feel that my aim is to really try them out or to give them a second life in a way, or to make them active, to, you know, to have this two kind of to make nostalgia energized, yes, to, I mean, to, you know, to have the two opposite in one. So my aim with the reference that I'm using is always to really to question them back as much as the ideas that they had behind them. So it's, you know, it's also this, as Silke mentioned, this idea of kind of referring to images and places that I would like to be a part of now, like the Salon, for example.
A space that you would like to be a part of now, but also spaces that are disappearing, that are overwritten. I mean, that's what I find so fascinating about this particular culture of an applied, fantastic consumer culture that is not capitalist, or where you realize that the introduction of turbo capitalism in the 90s erased a particular joy of consumption that has to do with kind of inventing your own real fictional space, be it that of the self-made sweaters, or a city that reinvents itself as some kind of fictional Paris, yeah, through neon signs.
Yeah. And I guess it's important for me, I mean, because one thing is, you know, having it all in your studio and kind of celebrating it inside, but the other side of it is also to make it kind of public. And this is why, especially with the neons, I'm very kind of proud that we have books on neon advertising that you can get in London, as well, pictures. There were even underwear with neon design made in Poland recently. But I was interested also to really activate them as public sculptures, I guess, or something that could be open to a discussion again, a public discussion.
I realize that we've already taken 1 hour going through the different, presenting the different works. So we could continue discussing on the panel, but I would at this point already open it up to the audience for questions, if you feel like joining in. Is there anybody who would like to go first? Any particular questions also related to the projects that we have introduced? No? But then I'll give you more time and start with the first round of questions. In a way, you're dealing not just with single objects, but a more general sense of a cultural unconsciousness, no? Like a culture that has produced certain manifestations during a time, and that by going back to these manifestations, you also tap into a particular spirit or humor of that time. How do you feel that resonating in these particular pieces? It's a very abstract question. What am I trying to say is that we started by talking about cultural artifacts, and obviously to a certain degree we're all dealing with these very particular objects, but then there's also something like a spirit, almost a ghost of a particular time, a humor that you're reinvoking. How do you deal with those spirits?
Where do you keep them?
Yeah.
I don't know, differently. I don't know how to answer this question.
Well, here obviously we have a spirit in a bottle. That's where they usually how they usually come. Oh, it's a cow in a bottle. Relating this back to where we started and the question of the cultural artifact, to what degree do you, Matthias, think about particular objects as related to periods or a period style or the spirit of a particular period?
Well, obviously, I mean, each sort of specific moments or emanations or cultural emanations of a period, the period is crucial to my interest on some level. At the same time, as I've said earlier, it's not necessarily something that this can necessarily be extrapolated from the way it manifests itself in the piece.
Yeah.
But I think more, maybe we should speak more generally about the notion of reference and sort of referentiality and sort of what that means today or what it has become on some level. Because obviously the referring or incorporating or sort of being very specific about where cultural material comes from as it is part of one's own work was at some point sort of a counter model to previous art productions. For example, if we take minimalism was something that was very much interested in being non-referential, in which maybe as if we take what Rosalind Krauss has said about minimalism is that it involves sort of the a deadpan, a sort of like a deadpan stare on something or in sort of uninflicted speech and repetition and sort of the production of objects that refer to nothing but themselves in sort of some sort of endless chain. And I think sort of historical at some point referring to specific histories and also specific articulations of art was a counter model that was intended to undermine sort of the artistic authority that typically is associated or was associated with art. And at the same time, it seems that clearly we're at a totally different cultural moment in which referring to all sorts of histories, not even histories, sort of like formal emanations, stylistic emanations, etc., has become sort of sort of such a common mode of art production that it seems to function in an entirely different way.
So you were saying basically that there is to underscore that a piece is historically situated was at one point a strong statement against work that just claims its space and pretends that it is completely.
Well, it was certainly some sort of subversion or the intent on some level was some sort of subversion or undermining of claims to originality and etc.
And how would you think that this cultural momentum has changed? That by now it is an established practice that this is how you situate your work, not boldly by claiming a new.
Well, it's such a common trope that it certainly is difficult to claim for it in general to have that sort of critical function, personally, I think it still has its validity on some level, but it really depends on how it's being manifested and articulated.
Questions? Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So the title of this lecture is Reference versus Reverence.
Yeah.
So are you choosing these artists to speak because they have a specific reverence to their some type of history? And you talked about the pitfalls and the dartboard. So how is their work falling outside of that?
I have huge problems understanding what you said because the acoustics are so bad.
Do you hear it?
Yeah,
okay, there you go. So you're talking about the dartboard and making these random references in recent traditions of art. How do these artists fall outside of that? And if they are more reverent to history, is that what's more important than the actual reference?
Anyway, I feel like I shouldn't be over-interpreting the work of the people that I invited and should rather give as much space and time as possible to the presentation of their works. I can just rephrase my own interest as saying that when I just flippantly brought in the term of reverence versus reference, I think reverence has a lot to do with the labor of love, which takes time, while the idea of reference as being just a strategical dartboard game is so much linked to the temporality of like an intentional move. Yes, I pull this or that out of the closet and bring it up as if it just could just be done. So on Monday you decide which reference to pick, and on Tuesday you realize it, and Wednesday someone writes a review that evaluates why this is an important move. So that is for me a particular temporality that I find very questionable. And what I love about the work of the people who have just presented is that I feel like with all of you there is a considerateness to the practice where it's quite clear that we're dealing with a long-term engagement that involves research, but that involves a certain politics of restaging, which, for instance, in Paulina's case, involved negotiating with people over how to install a neon. So this temporality then actually continues way into the bureaucratic struggles, I don't know, with the city of Warsaw, or in the case of Zirke's painting, where the temporality of engaging with someone like Yvonne Rainer, for instance, is, as you said, is a time frame that continues or that extends over a period of 4, 5, 6 years and is an open-ended process of revisiting something and somehow inhabiting that space, which I love about the Florin Stettheimer paintings, because for me they're almost paradigmatic in that they point to how you might relate to another artist's work by creating a space that you inhabit together with it, where the space is your painting but also her space. And in all these gestures I find something that goes beyond the dart game and opens up a different temporality of living with somebody else's work over a longer period and going back to it, questioning it. Or, and I guess in Matthias' work, just this kind of nagging questions, at what point do we actually get to the core of the thing? No? Like, we can drag in the object, but still something is missing. Or we can restage a cultural moment by having a band rehearse. But are we there yet? And a lot of, I think, more authoritative approaches to history try to mute that feeling. Like, yes, the big movie tries to tell you, yes, we are in 1984. See, we've got all the right road signs. And to allow for that question, did it ever happen? Are we back there yet? To allow for that skepticism to enter a work, I think, is a very critical momentum, because it diffuses this idea that we could just kind of pick and choose and throw it out there, which I think is a very capitalist approach. No, the idea that every reference is something that you could get from the supermarket shelf and just throw it out there, that we could just consume at will. This is why I also find Paulina's approach to consumption very beautiful. Now that we understand that consumption is not just possible in the capitalist mode, where you order it online and you get it, you devour it, and then you move on to the next, but where consumption actually once existed as a particularly different form of creativity. But to go back to that takes a lot of time, and it involves this labor of love, of researching, working together with people to restage the neon or to get the theater painted, which I think is an emotional time space that extends far beyond the limits of just a willful, arbitrary, intentional chess game or dart game. I'm getting signs to conclude. And maybe we should. Now, thank you all very much for being here on this rainy early morning.